April 2nd, and the first Monday of every month from here on in. Got questions? Find us on Facebook at 2Raw4Radio. Comedy, 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 comedy.
That's 2Raw4Radio, comedy to support WBAI Radio. April 2nd at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons, 388 Atlantic Avenue in the Borough Hill section of Brooklyn.
Lord Holmes, it's Lady Vera Clodsworth murdered by a red-speckled East Indian viper snake.
Not exactly, Dr. Watson. Look, the blue clay under her fingernails is only found in one place in the entire country, Baker Street.
But Holmes, wait, that's right here.
Exactly. She wasn't killed by a viper, Watson. She was bored to death by listening to your wireless over there. Blah, 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 blah.
Good Lord, it's boring.
Quick, Watson, we're in luck. It's Thursday, 2 p.m. Turn the dial to WBAI and tune in to Arts Express. Its eclectic mixture of interviews, reviews, political and artistic talk is stimulating enough to wake the dead.
Welcome to Arts Express. This is Prairie Miller.
Look, Holmes, she's waking up. Holmes, you've done it again.
Elementary, my dear Watson.
That's Arts Express with host Prairie Miller, 2 p.m. on Thursdays, WBAI 99.5 FM.
On Sunday, April 1st at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents drummer, composer, and poet William Hooker. Join us as we discuss William Hooker's Migration Suite in preparation for his presentation at Brooklyn's Roulette. That's Sunday, April 1st at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web.
Greetings, this is Savion Glover, and you're listening to WBAI in New York. Enjoy.
And welcome to Help Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Catherine Davis and Bob Litter. In this week's program, during the first half, we're going to be taking a look at the new moves that the Trump administration is making to limit people's access to the Medicaid program, the various ways they're doing it, getting an update on all that, and how advocacy forces are responding, and how you, a listener, can take action too. But first, we'll start with the Health Action news for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. The congressional newspaper The Hill reports that the omnibus federal government spending bill President Trump signed last week includes a clarification stating that the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention can conduct research on gun violence. However, public health experts and former agency officials say that unless Congress actually appropriates money for that research, no real progress will be made. Democrats have frequently railed against the fact that a 1996 law has effectively stopped the agency from researching gun violence. The mass shooting at a Florida high school last month has reignited the debate in Congress. Democrats have pushed for a full repeal of the so-called Dickey Amendment, which prohibits the use of federal funding to promote or advance gun control. But Republicans did not agree. Instead, leaders agreed to a one-sentence compromise explaining the Dickey Amendment. The restricting amendment was inserted into a 1996 government funding bill by the late Representative Jay Dickey, for whom the amendment is named, and it has been renewed annually since then. The new clarification states, quote, "While appropriations language prohibits the CDC and other agencies from using appropriated funding to advocate or promote gun control, the Secretary of Health and Human Services has stated the CDC has the authority to conduct research on the causes of gun violence," close quote. Republicans have argued that the CDC has always had the authority to conduct research into gun violence, and the agency has essentially engaged in self-censorship because the Dickey Amendment doesn't explicitly ban such research. Public health advocates and Democrats say that an explicit ban doesn't matter because the Dickey Amendment has created a chilling effect on research for more than 20 years. They also say the agency can't do the research when there isn't any money appropriated for it. The new budget bill does not provide new money for gun violence research, and top Republican lawmakers have said they have no interest in actually funding new federal research into gun violence. Kaiser Health News reports that people living with disabilities, serious illness, and frailty of old age are bracing to lose their personal caregivers due to changes in federal and Trump administration immigration policy. About 59,000 Haitians living in the U.S. under temporary protected status, a humanitarian program that gave them permission to work and live here after the 2010 earthquake devastated their country. Many of them work in home health care, often in grueling low-wage jobs such as nurses' assistants or home health aides. Now these workers' days are numbered. The Trump administration has decided to end temporary protected status for Haitians, giving them until July 2019 to leave the country or face deportation. The decision has prompted panic from TPS holders and pleas from healthcare agencies that rely on their labor. The fallout offers a glimpse into how changes in immigration policy are affecting older, disabled, and chronically ill people in communities around the country, especially in large cities like New York. Nationwide, 1 million immigrants work in direct care as certified nurses' assistants, personal care attendants, or home health aides, according to the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute, a New York City-based organization that studies the healthcare workforce. Immigrants make up 1 in 4 of these paraprofessional workers. Turnover is high because the work is difficult and wages are low. The median wage for personal care attendants and home health aides is about $10.66 per hour and $12.78 per hour for certified nurse assistants. Workers can often receive little training, and they often leave when they find modestly paying higher paying jobs in other fields. The U.S. already faces a severe shortage in home health aides, with 10,000 baby boomers turning 65 every day. An even more serious shortfall lies ahead, a national shortfall of about 150,000 direct care workers by the year 2030, a gap that will grow to 355,000 by the year 2040. The shortage will escalate if immigrant workers lose work permits or if other industries raise wages and lure away direct care workers. Healthcare employers are fighting to hold on to their personal care staff. Healthcare providers and advocacy groups have written to the Department of Homeland Security urging the acting secretary to extend the temporary protected status program. It's not clear how many direct care workers rely on TPS, but the Paraprofessional Healthcare Institute calculates there are 34,600 who are non-U.S. citizens from Haiti, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras, all countries who currently have temporary protected status designations. In addition, another 11,000 come from countries affected by the Trump administration's new travel ban, primarily from Somalia and Iran, and about 70,000 are non-U.S. citizens from Mexico. Even immigrants with secure legal status may be affected when their family members are deported. And finally, the Associated Press reports that thanks to the new federal spending bill, the government will now spend a record $4.6 billion this year to fight the deepening opioid crisis, which killed 42,000 Americans in the year 2016. However, advocates say the funding included in the new plan the president signed last week is not nearly enough to establish the kind of treatment system needed to actually reverse the crisis. A White House report last fall put the cost of the country of the opioid epidemic at more than $500 billion a year. The new budget amount amounts to about three times as much as the federal government has currently been spending to address the epidemic, not counting the treatment money that flows through the Medicare and Medicaid programs. A spokesman for the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services says the agency does not specifically track how much money it spends on those programs for opioid addiction treatment. The biggest chunk of new money is $1 billion, is to be distributed to states and American Indian tribes. States with the highest overdose mortality rates would receive larger shares, a provision that's important to hard-hit states with smaller populations, such as West Virginia and New Hampshire. However, every state would receive at least $4 million. Other provisions in the plan also include $500 million for opioid-related research and $100 million more to expand treatment availability. Money for law enforcement and equipment to help identify and intercept opioids at borders and ports of entry, helping people being released from prison avoid returning to recreational drug use, and expanding specialized courts for veterans and people with drug dependency. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back in a moment taking a look at what the Trump administration is doing to make radical changes to the Medicaid program. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In the first half of this week's program, we're going to be taking a look at what the Trump administration is doing to make some radical changes to Medicaid, which primarily will, in effect, limit access to the program in terms of people getting on it or staying on it. Joining us to help give us a little primer on all this is Leonard Coelho, who's Director of Health Policy with the National Health Law Program. Welcome to the program, Leo.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's do a little bit of Medicaid 101 to set the floor here for our conversation. What is the Medicaid program? Essentially, how does it work?
So Medicaid is our national program that provides health coverage to low-income children, pregnant women, older adults, persons with disabilities, parents, and many others. So what you're really talking about is a program that provides health care for 70 million of the most vulnerable people in this country. So it's just a lifeline for individuals. It's also really important to states because the federal government, through Medicaid, gives states billions of dollars to provide Medicaid coverage for enrollees in the states. So it's not just a requirement on states to provide care. It's also a lot of money to actually provide the care.
Yeah, so let's dig down on that a little bit. So states are really in the driver's seat when it comes to the Medicaid program. What do they have to do, and what are some options that they may or may not do?
So in basic terms, if states, first of all, get to choose whether they participate in Medicaid. It's totally voluntary, but it turns out that all 50 states plus D.C. participate. The reason they do is, as I mentioned, that generous federal funding. To participate, there are certain populations they have to cover. So, for example, they have to cover pregnant women who are in poverty. And then they have optional populations that they can choose to cover if they want. Likewise, they have mandatory services. So there are certain services they must provide to everybody, certain healthcare services. And then there are healthcare services that are optional, that they can choose to provide if they want to. And, of course, all of the time that they're providing any of these healthcare services to people, they are getting federal funding in support of those services.
Now, there was a big expansion or change to the Medicaid program that happened under the Affordable Care Act. What was that change?
So the Affordable Care Act created a new category in Medicaid called the Medicaid, what we call the Medicaid expansion. The key thing to understanding Medicaid before the Affordable Care Act is that there were a lot of people who, it turns out, didn't get covered by our program for low-income people, even though those people were low-income. And the reason is that to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to be two things. You have to be low-income, but you also have to fit into one of the categories. So, for example, you have to be a child, or you have to have a disability, or you have to be an older adult, or you have to be a woman in treatment for breast or cervical cancer. And so it turned out that there were all of these people out there who were low income but weren't able to check the box for one of those categories, right? I'm just a, you know, 30-year-old woman. Yeah, 30-year-old woman. I'm not pregnant. I don't have a disability. I don't have breast cancer, and I can't get health care. And so there was this gap. And so what the Medicaid expansion did is it basically created one more category, but the new category said everybody else. Everybody else who is low income, isn't fitting into one of the other traditional categories, gets to come into this new category. And that new category was supposed to be mandatory in every state Medicaid program. And what happened is the Supreme Court came in a decision that is, frankly, you know, is unprecedented in how terrible it is. The Supreme Court said, you know what, we're not going to allow every state to be required to do this. Instead, we're going to let the states choose whether they want to do this. And that's how we get to this crazy world we're in now, where we have 32 states that have chosen to do this, but we have 19 states that don't. So, for example, in the Washington, D.C. area, if you happen to be in Maryland and you happen to be – or you happen to be in the District of Columbia – you have a Medicaid expansion option. If you are in Virginia, you don't have a Medicaid expansion option. So it's an extremely unfair result and an extremely unfortunate situation.
So that's where this whole issue of what they're trying to do to the – what the new Trump administration is trying to do to the Medicaid program kind of begins to – establish a beachhead, shall we say. But first, let's talk a little bit. They're trying to do this through a process of what's called a waiver. In sort of layperson's terms, what is a waiver in the context of Medicaid?
Right. So a waiver is an exception. And to understand this, you have to understand the way Medicaid works, right? So as we said, the federal government is giving these states billions of dollars. But in exchange for that money, the states have to play by the rules. They have to comply with federal health care standards. For example, under the law, states are not allowed to charge somebody who lives in poverty a monthly premium to get their Medicaid coverage, because, of course, people in poverty might not be able to afford to pay that monthly premium and would lose their coverage. So if states want the federal money, which they do, then they have to comply with the requirements. And that's where these waivers come in. They're essentially exceptions. It turns out that the head of Health and Human Services, who runs Medicaid and is a Trump appointee, has the authority to grant exceptions to the normal rules. And we call those waivers because they're waiving the normal legal requirement. But under the law, the head of HHS is only supposed to grant exceptions for an innovative healthcare experiment that helps furnish healthcare. Right? So they're supposed to grant exceptions to improve care, but the Trump administration is essentially ignoring that part of the law and just granting exceptions more or less wherever they feel like it. And so they're misusing the authority. I would say they're abusing the authority to grant exceptions that will wipe out consumer protections.
Right. So, for instance, here in New York, we've had a waiver program in our Medicaid program for 20 years now, and it was an innovation at the time to expand coverage to people, low-income people, as you described earlier, who didn't qualify into one of those pre-Affordable Care Act categories. But in exchange, people on Medicaid were limited to certain provider networks that they had to use. So that was the trade-off. And it, you couldn't necessarily go to any doctor or hospital you wanted to. You had to stay in network. But in exchange, the state got this money to cover all these new people that couldn't qualify before. So that's kind of the trade-off we're talking about here, something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, so when waivers are used, typically – it is supposed to be to somehow improve access to coverage. So you see states doing expansions of coverage. You see states doing more care management programs. You see states providing family planning services to women who aren't otherwise eligible for Medicaid, because that reduces the amount of pregnancy care that we end up having to provide women who, you know, unfortunately have unintended pregnancies when they don't want to be doing that. Mm-hmm. So we ideally see that under the law, the way the law is written, these waivers are supposed to help increase access to care for consumers.
Okay, so the ACA comes in, and a bunch of states, as you indicated, did not elect to choose the Medicaid expansion. And so then they started to apply for these waivers under the Obama administration. What happened there? Because that sort of sets the context for what Trump bills on.
Right. So under the Obama administration, they made, you know, what you would call a rational calculation. I actually came out on the other side of the calculation of the Obama administration. But what the Obama administration basically said is, we're willing to let some states get some exceptions to some requirements, some consumer protections that we normally would not like to let the states do this, but in exchange, that state is going to expand their Medicaid program and hundreds of thousands of people are going to gain coverage. So basically, we're gaining hundreds of thousand people coverage in exchange for letting their care be suboptimal in a couple of ways that we don't like. But the difference now is that the waivers that are being approved are much, much worse, and they are not in exchange for new expansions. What you have are states that have already expanded Medicaid going to the Trump administration trying to get waivers to cut out consumer protections. And then you have other states coming in saying, we also want to cut consumer protections, and we're not even going to do a new expansion. So essentially, in exchange for worse things happening, we're getting nothing. Nobody is getting coverage. So whereas under the Obama administration, this was part of a very rational calculation. We are going to get a whole lot of people coverage, and in exchange for that, we're going to let them, you know, charge a higher copay than we would normally allow or something like that. In this case, they are letting them do a ton of terrible things, and nobody's getting new coverage.
Now, you mentioned the Trump administration. The person who really oversees this whole process, the director of the Center for Medicaid and Medicaid Services, which is the agency that oversees Medicaid, is someone that comes out of Vice President Pence's regime and or administration in Indiana when he was the governor. And there was a waiver granted in that case by the Obama administration to the then Pence administration that sort of set the stage for all that. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah. So the Indiana situation is actually kind of a horse of its own color, and there's a reason for that. Indiana was a state that, full credit to them, chose to expand Medicaid before the Affordable Care Act expansion was even available, right? So they had kind of on their own already expanded Medicaid. So when the Medicaid expansion through the Affordable Care Act came along, Indiana said to the Obama administration, we kind of want to keep doing it the way we've been doing it all along. And the Obama administration said, no, now under the law, there is a formal Medicaid expansion, and this is the way you're supposed to do it. And they had a back-and-forth fight about it. And essentially, Mike Pence had President Obama kind of in a corner, because if President Obama did not approve the waivers in Indiana, Mike Pence was going to shut down the Indiana expansion and say, listen, it's not my fault. The federal government, the president, made me shut down this program. And so the Obama administration had a lot of pressure on it to cut a deal with Indiana that, you know, Indiana and the feds could live with. So they approved more waivers, more exceptions to consumer protections in Indiana than they had done in any state. But that was in part, it was in fact totally because Indiana had expanded early, and they didn't want to punish Indiana for expanding early. So in that sense, Indiana is sort of a very special case scenario.
Right. Okay. But we can see where they're going. So now the Trump administration is in control. They've got states submitting proposals to them to do this, that, and the other thing. And before we get into the particulars, maybe in general, what's kind of driving this process of states coming to the Trump administration saying, let me do this, let me do that, let me do the other thing?
I think there are a lot of reasons. One piece is ideological, right? The political right doesn't believe people have a right to health care. They view Medicaid as a welfare program that should only be provided to a small group of people who are especially worthy of help. So maybe they would provide coverage to an infant, but they wouldn't provide coverage to the infant's parents. So they want to take Medicaid back in time to when a much smaller group of people were eligible and sort of ignore the regular expansions that Congress has mandated over the years, realizing it was really arbitrary to leave so many people out of the system. And a second reason is simply financial, right? They want to cut the program to spend less money. If you disenroll a lot of people from Medicaid, the cost of the program goes down. And in this case, right, they just passed tax breaks for millionaires that were really expensive. And so now they want to pay for that by slashing health care for poor and working class people. I mean, that's what's going on.
Right. So that's sort of on the federal level. So let's take a look at what the Trump administration is doing. And let's, in particular, use an example, the state of Kentucky. They had done a Medicaid expansion previously under the Obama administration. And now they've submitted a proposal to the Trump administration to say, we want to change the deal here. What did they propose, and what did the what has the Trump administration said or done?
Yeah. So Kentucky is really the first major state that the Trump administration approved back in January, and it's a really sad example. They have requested 8 exceptions. One, to charge premiums, and again, we're talking low-income people here. A second, to do a lockout, meaning that if people don't pay the premium, they not only get terminated from the program, but they get locked out of coverage for 6 months, meaning they can't come back in. There also is, third, a lockout for failing to submit your annual renewal papers on time, just your paperwork. Fourth, there is a lockout if you fail to report changes on time. So if your income changes and you fail to report it on time, you get locked out for 6 months. There is a 60-day waiting period to enroll for some people. There is no retroactive coverage, meaning you can't get coverage prior to the date you applied, which is a normal Medicaid thing. There is, seventh, a work requirement, which, no matter what it sounds like, is in fact requiring people to provide documentation proving they work, and if they fail to produce documentation, you terminate them from the program. And eighth, eliminating transportation services that enrollees rely on. So you take all 8 of those exceptions, all exceptions to what are normally consumer protections that are required to be in place under the law, and even Kentucky itself estimates that 100,000 people will lose coverage. So you see, it's a really devastating list of things done simply to reduce access to coverage.
And then in the wake of that, then Indiana comes forward back into the scene again and says, we want to make some changes too. So what have they done under the new Trump-Pence administration, I should say, particularly in this case?
Yeah, so in the Indiana approval looks almost exactly the same as the Kentucky approval. One of the 3 lockouts that Kentucky has, Indiana does not have, and Indiana has an additional punishment, a premium surcharge for people who smoke. So it is remarkably similar to what was approved in Kentucky, and one can expect that the impacts of it are also going to be, you know, remarkably similar. In other words, bad.
Right. And the other state that now has come forward is the state of Arkansas, which also did a Medicaid expansion through a waiver under the Obama administration and now has come back and said, we want to recut the deal, too. What happened there?
Yeah, again, so you have many similar things. You have work requirements. You have lockouts. You have the retroactive coverage component of it. So the Arkansas one I would describe as a little less harsh because it doesn't have quite as many waivers, but the ultimate direction of it is very similar. What you can see in each of these waivers, and this is important as we'll keep discussing this, you can see that they are designed to reduce access to coverage, right? And they are designed to make it so that people are either terminated from the program. Sometimes they get terminated and locked out, so they can't get back in. Sometimes we reduce the amount of months that they can get coverage for, right? So you put in a waiting period, so now all of a sudden the first 2 months they can't get any coverage. And then sometimes you're reducing the amount of services they get if they're covered. So you take away the transportation services, right? And so the kind of net effect of it is dramatically reducing access to care for the individuals.
And the transportation services is what allows them to come and go to the doctor's office.
Right. I mean, a state like Kentucky, Indiana, Arkansas, these are states with plenty of rural areas where transportation can be a major barrier to people who are low income being able to make it to the doctor's office. And of course, the same thing happens in urban areas where you do have more public transportation available, but you have to be able to pay public transportation. And that means, importantly, you have to have the money for the public transportation in your pocket the same day that you happen to have your doctor's appointment, right? And if that doesn't happen, you miss the appointment. So the transportation support is absolutely critical. And of course, we have to add to that fact that a lot of the people in Medicaid, you have people who have all kinds of disabling conditions, chronic conditions, formal disabilities, et cetera. And those individuals may actually not be able to access the public transportation to make it to the doctor's office. So they also need, specific supports.
Okay, so your organization is a public interest law firm based in Washington. You and your colleagues are pushing back on this stuff that Trump is trying to do to Medicaid. What are you doing?
Right. So, we've talked about all of the reasons why this is a terrible policy. These exceptions that they're granting to consumer protections result in people getting less access to care. It turns out they're also illegal. So we have filed a class action lawsuit. This is in regards to Kentucky, the first state approved. We filed a class action lawsuit. We have 15 plaintiffs, people in Kentucky who will be hurt by this. And we filed it against the Department of Health and Human Services, CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and their leadership in district court, federal district court here in D.C., along with some co-counsel, including some great attorneys from Kentucky, the Kentucky Equal Justice Center and the Southern Poverty Law Center. And we're basically asking the court to declare these exceptions to be illegal and to block them so that, these consumer protections won't be erased.
And how has the Trump administration made any response to your moves?
So at this point, HHS, Health and Human Services, has requested the case be transferred from the D.C. District Court where we filed it to the Eastern District Court of Kentucky, and not just the Eastern District Court, but the Central Division, and not just the Central Division, but the Frankfurt Docket, which has a grand total of one judge. So they are they have sort of cherry-picked who they think is a judge who will give them a favorable outcome, and they're requesting to transfer the case to that specific court so they can get the judge they want on the case. But right now we are waiting for a decision from the district court about whether or not they're willing to transfer the case from D.C. to Kentucky.
And lastly, as we kind of wrap up, what can either people who are currently on Medicaid, wherever they may be around the country, or people who are concerned about what the Trump administration is doing to Medicaid, what can we do, if anything?
So there's a lot that can be done. I think one of the first points that, I would make to people is, yes, we've filed a lawsuit regarding what's been done in Kentucky, but that's a really suboptimal result, right? We don't want to be filing lawsuits. We want nobody to be trying to do something harmful in the first place. And so that really means that we need people in their states where they live saying, hey, we don't want this for our state's Medicaid program. We want people who are low income and vulnerable, older adults, children, pregnant women, to be able to access their care, to be eligible for care, to be actually enrolled and actually able to access their care. That's what we want. And it turns out that obviously there's political pressure that people can put on, but there is also a formal comment process, meaning when the state decides that they want to try and request these kinds of exceptions from the Trump administration, they have to have two public hearings. And they have to put a proposal in writing, and they have to accept comments from the public for a 30-day period at the state level, and then the federal government will do the same thing and accept comments for a 30-day period. And so you can actually submit comments saying, hey, this is a bad idea. Here's why I think it's a bad idea. Here's how it would hurt me. So there is both, kind of normal political activity you can be involved in. There is comment writing you can be involved in to share whatever your opinion is. If you're for this, you can submit comments to say, hey, I'm in favor of this. If you're against it, you can submit comments to say you're against it. And obviously the same thing with the political process. You can support it if you support it, or you can oppose it if you oppose it.
And you don't have to be a health policy expert to do any of this, right?
No. In fact, you could, for example, contact a state representative, or you could submit the comments and you could tell your own story and say, you know, I'm somebody who either is enrolled in Medicaid, or I know somebody who's enrolled in Medicaid, or I might one day be enrolled in Medicaid, and here's why I think this or that other thing is the right approach. You know, here's why I think it's really important that people be able to access care, or, you know, why I think it's really important that people be able to have coverage consistently over time. Because, for example, I'm managing my diabetes, and if I don't have insurance for 3 months, my diabetes gets really poorly controlled, and I have a lot of serious health outcomes that can happen with that, right? And many people are in exactly that position.
Well, we've been talking about the Trump administration's new moves to make some radical changes to Medicaid, and it's all primarily, as our guest has indicated, around actually limiting access to the program. And we've been talking at the end here about what can be done about it. Our guest has been Leonard Coelho, who's the Director of Health Policy for the National Health Law Program at Public Interest Law Firm in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us a good understanding of this, Leo.
Happy to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And thank you. And stay tuned. We'll be back second half of the program with Catherine Davis. I'm Mark Hannay. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this part of the program.
Good morning to all of you tuned in. I'm Catherine. On this program, we do our best to bring you information that is useful and hopefully inspiring and providing resources and means to expand your own being, your awareness, your integration, your work in the world. And one of the things I've been very blessed to be able to do is have a presentation at this New Life Expo. And one of the things that's really interesting is how much people are really expanding in their understanding and also expanding in their willingness, their capacity to be open and to explore and to really begin to challenge those ideas that have been programmed into our head, or perhaps it's those ideas that we grew up with the assumption that the world was a particular way, that our lives should follow a particular path. And it's really interesting because so many of us are indeed searching for a way to refresh our lives, perhaps. I think we are all truly walking the path that we came into the world to walk, however that may look. Sometimes it looks like a challenge and sometimes it looks wonderful. But we are on our path. And as we walk through our life and engage in our experiences, we have opportunities to make choices, to be more empowered in the path that we follow. And I say this because we come in with certain ideas in terms of where we want to go. We have certain talents that we can have access to as we're born into the world and we begin to grow in the world. So we have a lot that comes with us. Also, what comes with us are certain challenges that are there for us to overcome and to grow. We meet these challenges as we move through our life. But in truth, there becomes a certain point when we want to leave some of these challenges behind, when we want to graduate in our lives to another level of expansion and understanding of where we are, who we are, and what we're capable of. We're capable of so much more than we realize. And part of the reason we are in this state of non-realization or misunderstanding about what we're capable of is because we don't have any more the traditions that help us along the way, help us along our path. So rather than coming into the world and going through our childhoods with a sense of reinforcement for whatever our talents might be, and rather than receiving some level of support and understanding and compassion for whatever our challenges may be, very often we are moved into a space of success, moved into a modality or the mode of believing that our destiny is to find a place in the world, to find some career or to find some form of expression that is going to be successful, that is going to bring the financial rewards that all of us need and really deserve in order to have a good life. And so we are motivated as children to flow into a direction that is perceived by the world as something that will support us as an adult. So a young child might be encouraged to study math or science or to have a comprehension of business. And so we are very often moved into this direction where we are studying something because it's recognized that this will bring financial rewards in a professional life. And very often, young girls are steered in an opposite direction, and depending on the family, but certainly my generation and maybe several generations before and after, women were more steered towards the idea that, well, our function is to provide a family and nurturing and loving in the family. And while that's essentially true, we're more in a world where both men and women have to carry the responsibility of income bringing as well as the responsibility of nurturing. And I think that this is probably a healthy development. But many women will feel more at ease flowing in that direction of knowing that I'm really interested in having a family. I'm not really interested in having a big, high-powered career. And then even women who are in careers very often have the nurturing role. And as much as things have changed as far as gender roles in the workplace, you'll still see more women in support roles and more men in the dominant role in the corporate structure. But all this to say that we're coming upon a time when it is very healthy to be able to reflect back to our core, our initial leanings and our inborn talents, to see where our gift lies so that we can begin to consciously steer ourselves in the direction that will be a response to the truth and the fullness of who we are and who we were born to be. So that being the texture of the conversation, I want to share with you some segments from the presentation that I offered at the New Life Expo. It was on vibrational intelligence. This is actually the fifth time that I have offered a lecture on this subject. It's really quite broad in terms of understanding fully what this means. So we're going to play this first clip, and then I'll come back and have a few more words to share with you on vibrational intelligence. So stay tuned as we listen, and we'll be right back.
Welcome. I'm really happy to have you here, and I'm happy to be here with you. I'm Catherine, and what we're going to talk about today is vibrational intelligence. And of course, we all have this because we are, in fact, vibrational beings. And so this is just a way of coming into an awareness of the truth of who we are and the truth of how our bodies and our lives function. And if we are to look at our body at the microscopic level, when you get below the atom, when you get all the way down, you're just going to see electrical charges. You're just going to see electricity and space. And so when we begin to regard ourselves in this way, we can begin to interact with our structure in a way that can transform it, because the precursor to reality is really consciousness, awareness, and feeling. I don't want to say thoughts, because thoughts for us in our reality have a tendency to function in a reactive mode. So our thinking mind is kind of cultivated over time, and it's more about survival. How am I going to make it to the next day? How am I going to get food? How do I get this, catch this animal? How do I grow this food? And our mind is really working in terms of reaching into the physical world and learning how to manipulate the physical world. So when we're talking about an energy awareness and the energy intelligence, it's in a way retreating from the physical world and moving into the inner world, where there's really just awareness and there's a sense of birthing. So when you're in your body, when you're in your awareness, everything is a birth rather than a thought. So if you're going into that deep sense of awareness, you can begin to have the intention to transform what is birthed into your life. And that's where the real power is in vibrational intelligence, because it allows you to understand how you created your life. Maybe it's a mess, maybe it's a success, but we create our life based on really the intention we hold and the energy of that intention. When we live our lives unconsciously, then we're creating out of our subconscious, we're creating out of our fear, we're creating out of programming. And so when we begin to at least acknowledge that we have this deeper awareness within us, then we can begin to understand what's going on inside of us that might be programming. And we are very often programmed towards being afraid. We're programmed towards needing something outside of ourselves to satisfy who we are and how we express in the world. So we end up with different kinds of disorders, eating disorders, drinking disorders, smoking. All of these come from being trained to get all of our stimuli from outside of our physical body. And when we're getting all of our impulses from outside, that means that you're not paying attention to what's rising out of your divine self, what's rising out of your core self. And all of that real power is in the invisible parts of us. And it's something that functions. Sometimes it functions in thoughts, or it can arise in thoughts, but mostly it's much more subtle. It comes through as an intuition. It comes through as a feeling. It comes through as a hunch. And we've been programmed from the outside not to trust that. And we have a tendency to ignore the wisdom that keeps coming up and bubbling up from inside of us. And everyone on the outside is like, oh, no, well, you better get a job. You better not do this. Or you have to go to school and you have to get a degree. Don't follow your hunch. Don't follow your intuition. Don't follow your passion. You have to do certain things to make it in the world. So we have all this stamped on us, and we doubt that wisdom that's arising from within. And that's really the thing that's going to have the energy and the power to transform your life, to change your world. The difficulty we have in moving forward is the conflict. So it may be that you're following your intuition, you know you want to take this path, but you still have the fear programming in your head. So you're like working against yourself. So I'm going for this. Oh, I can't go. I'm afraid. I'm going to do this. No, I better not. I have to do that. You know. So it's this friction of the fear and the intuition that really holds us back. And the, one of the other things that also holds us back, I was talking to someone a few minutes ago, is the surrounding energies around us. All the people around us who don't understand, who don't really support what you want to do, who might be beautiful, loving people, but they can't hold a higher vibration, and their energies will have a tendency to dampen our own energies or the confidence that we might have. So there are a lot of issues in vibrational intelligence, and there are some challenges to it. But at the core, there needs to be a realization truly of how sacred each one of you are. It's like you're the only being that is expressing as you. And there are, you know, billions of people on the earth. And so everyone is so sacred and so special. And we start from recognizing that in ourselves and being able to say, wow, I can really love myself. I can really appreciate myself. I can really see this journey that I've been on. I can see the challenges. I can have compassion for me because I'm facing all these things. And so it's really important in connecting to your true vibration is to be able to really appreciate who you are, to really understand and have compassion for who you are, because that's the ground from which everything else blossoms. And so when you can say to yourself, and it doesn't matter how long we've been on the earth, someone could be here at 5 and 8 and have real worldly life problems that somebody at 60 might never have experienced. And then there's somebody who could be 60 or 70, and, you know, it's like they're carrying bricks the whole time. Their life has been such a struggle. So it's not about age. It's just about recognizing that when we're born into the world, it's almost as if we're born into the world as this perfect, wise, gifted, beautiful being. Unfortunately, at that moment, we can't talk, so we can't tell anybody what we know. And by the time we can talk, it's all been programmed out of us. But if you look into a baby's eyes, you can see how wise they are and how open and how heartfelt they are. And that's the natural state of a human being. We all could be that. And the key is to think of how you feel when you look at that baby and hold that feeling for yourself and remember yourself as that little baby and that innocence and that sweetness. And that's how you want to relate to yourself. And that begins to start you percolating at the right vibration to be able to dispel the fear, to be able to move through your life with the courage to really be grounded in your truth, because that's the other part of it, that you come into the world with an essential piece of the truth. Not everybody knows the same thing, but everybody has something essential. And so we start to nurture ourselves so that essence can grow through us and blossom into the world. So if you think of our bodies as really earth, we're really Gaia, we're a planet. When you think of all the substance of our physical body, We're basically little drops of earth walking around. And the essence of our soul is planted into the earth like it's planted into our body. And how we treat that essence will determine how sturdy our gift rises into the world. And so if you think of your gift into the world like a tree rising out of the earth, then your gift is like coming out of your heart and opening up into the world just like a tree. And the only way that we can really nurture and cultivate that is to nurture and cultivate ourselves just like the earth. Have to water it, have to till the soil. You know, so when we begin to think of ourselves that way, then we can pull out of the madness of the world that we're living in, because, well, it is what it is, but we don't want to be trapped in it. You know, it's fine to do the things you love and be with the people you love and go to movies. Nothing is wrong with the world, but we don't want to be trapped in it. We want to be able to go into the world, do what we need to do, be at work, be at play, and then come home. And when you come home, you're thinking of coming into the self, coming into the deepest part of yourself. And when you're in the deepest part of yourself, then all of the judgments and all of the conflicts begin to fade, and you can really begin to realize how fake all of that is. The world is really kind of fake. And the truth, the real essence, the thing that's true, is you. It's not what's on the TV, it's not the corporations, it's not the teachers, it's not what people tell you. Almost everything is fake. The only real thing is what's happening inside, deep inside of you. And when you recognize that, and the next person recognizes it, and you connect through the eyes and you see it, you could see that beauty in the person's eyes, and they see it in your eyes. And that's how we can begin to live our lives in a way that is beautiful and that honors who we are as beings. So that's really what vibrational intelligence is. It's about really honoring the truth and the expansiveness of who and what we are, because we are not only vibrational, but we're multidimensional. So a lot of times when we have dreams, or when we visualize, or we have an imagination, that's real. It doesn't feel tangible to us because we're used to such a solid existence. But anything that's happening inside of you is actually real. And on some level, it's occurring in some dimension, in some part of you. So you could be, you know, a little kid walking down the street chewing gum, kicking cans, and you still could be an astronaut in a spaceship navigating space. And it's the same being, but it's because we're multidimensional. And third dimension, we're living our lives here. Fourth dimension is kind of a dream dimension. Fifth dimension is just as like this, not as physical, but it's a much more expanded awareness. And each density gets like that. And we are currently living concurrently in each density, in each dimension. And we may be different expressions. And so a lot of you probably have heard of past lives. There are past lives, there are future lives, and there are concurrent lives. So from the perspective of your true essence, you could think of yourself as being at this level. So you're a being, and when you're at a really high density, it's two beings, male, female, make up one being. It's a sort of a joint being. And so up here, you can see, have a really big perspective. And these beings will have a being living at this level. It's the same being, but because this is male, female, you might become two people here, a male and a female. And then say this is seventh and this is fifth. And then from the fifth density down to where we are, this two could be five. So just to give a sense of our multidimensional selves. Now, from here, it all looks like it's happening at the same time. From our level, this could be a past life in the 18th century. This can be a future life in the 28th century. This could be now. And that's how multidimensionality works. You're living here, but you're also in the future. You're also in the past, according to the perspective of the soul from the seventh dimension. So to us, it looks like a past life. To the soul, it looks like it's happening at the same time. But the real gem of it is that when we begin to expand our capacity to read energies and to read intelligence, you could communicate to those other beings that are you in those other places. And so it gets a little complicated, but it's not as complicated as you would think. But part of it is just beginning to bridge the awareness that this is what's possible for you. So for instance, you might have been born into this life, could have been born anywhere, but for some reason you just feel like you should be someplace peaceful. A lot of us feel that way. Well, it may very well be that you were a monk or a nun in some part of your life. Or you might come into this life and you just feel a kind of restlessness. Don't know where it comes from. It may be that in another life you were an explorer. And so what happens when you expand your multidimensional perception, you can go into meditation and say, okay, I feel this restlessness. Where is it coming from? You don't ever have to really know, but what happens is the awareness connects, and the part of you that was an explorer can deliver to you a message of what it learned in its life that can satisfy your discontent in this life. And so that's all part of what is possible when you begin to open into that multi-dimensional vibrational awareness.
Multi-dimensional vibrational awareness. So it's a beautiful reality that we're a part of, that we are functioning within. And we're really living at a time when it's become very easy and necessary, actually, to begin to integrate the multidimensional truth of who we are. So when I say integrate, I don't necessarily mean, you know, merging the actual beingness from different realities, except in the level of awareness.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. If you missed any of Health Action, you can hear all of it in its entirety in about 5 or 10 minutes by going to WBAI.org. And that is true of all the shows on WBAI. If you come in the middle, go to the website afterwards and you can hear the whole thing, or at your leisure. Coming up next is Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf with substitute host Ken Gale. So stay tuned. We'll be talking about the Green Book, which was published from 1936 to 1967 and helped black families find places during Jim Crow that they could get gas or eat in. And we'll be talking about Charles Schulz's work besides Peanuts. We'll be talking about Captain Billy's Whiz Bang and a Diane Duane graphic novel. And so there's a lot to talk about, and I'll be interviewing Nat Gertler.
I wanna be like them. I wanna be.
Were the Tearjerkers with Comic Book Hero. I'm Ken Gale, and this is the Nuff Said version of Jim Freund's Hour of the Wolf. Jim will be back next week, and I'm subbing for him, and bring an interview with Nat Gertler and some fascinating books that he publishes. First, a couple of announcements. One is the East Coast Comic Con is going to be April 27 to April 29, Friday to Sunday, in Secaucus, New Jersey. So 355 Plaza Drive, Secaucus, New Jersey. So that we're not talking about the Javits Center car show type of Comic-Con. We're talking about a comic book convention. East Coast Comic-Con, April 27 to April 29. And the next New York Review of Science Fiction Reading, produced by Jim Freund, is next Tuesday, April 3rd, at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe, 388 Atlantic Avenue, starting at 7 p.m. The readers are novelist Chandler Klang Smith and prose and comic book writer Chris Claremont. Admission is free, though we request donations for the series. We hope to end by 9 p.m. so we can all race home to watch season 2 premiere of Chris's TV show, Legion. If you're a regular Nuff Said listener, you certainly know who Chris Claremont is. He's probably best known for writing the X-Men, and for years was considered the best writer in comics. And he's been written quite a few novels, and he'll be reading from one of them next Tuesday. And my guest is Nat Gertler, who writes comics, he draws comics, and he publishes comics, and he publishes a lot of other stuff. So welcome to WBAI, Nat.
Glad to be here.
I suppose since I am subbing for a science fiction show, we should start by talking about the graphic novel by Diane Duane that you published.
Yes, The Misadventures of Prince Ivan. What we did there was collect. She'd done a serial for Eclipse Comics back in the 1980s. She wrote it, and a woman by the name of Sherlock had drawn the whole thing, and that had been lying around, never collected, and I'm sitting there thinking this is very entertaining. It's sort of more folk tales, a humorous take on folk tales, maybe a pre-Shrek Shrek, really. So I always really enjoyed it. So it was lying around, and I said, I'd like to collect that. It may not be quite enough for a book, so I contacted Diane, contacted Sherlock, got them to do a new backup story, and issued that a number of years ago, and that's still available.
And I'm a huge Diane Duane fan, and I hope every regular listener of Hour of the Wolf is as well. She's probably best known either for her So You Want to Be a Wizard series or for writing Star Trek TV shows, Star Trek comic books, and Star Trek novels, but a tremendous writer. And and if she ever shows up at a convention near you, go see her. She is a wonderful speaker as well.
Mm-hmm. And she's got a great range. This humorous stuff, I mean, obviously she'd be a little sense of humor to a lot of her stuff, but this pure humor folktale take may be a surprise for some of her readers.
Spock's World is very strong science. She really runs the gamut. And So You Want to Be a Wizard is a bunch of kids studying to be magicians before Harry Potter. They didn't go to a special school. They did this after school in their spare time, but had adventures as they learned magic. Anyway, if Diane Duane is not familiar to you, look it up. And The Misadventures of Prince Ivan, she's sort of satirizing fairy tales and yet using the fairy tale medium to tell actually a wonderful story about a prince and his three sisters.
Mm-hmm.
The artwork is very busy. It reminds me of the underground comics of the early 70s.
Oh yeah, Sherlock was definitely able, willing to throw things in, and it's a very cartoony sensibility going on there, so it works pretty well. And that was really an example of one of the things I like to do is stuff that was lying around anyway, and people may have not, it was never in a book, people have forgotten it exists, but it's Diane Duane. There's no reason there wasn't a book of this.
That's for sure.
You know, New York Times bestselling author did a whole graphic novel's worth of material. It should be available. It shouldn't be just sitting there in back issue boxes where you have to buy, you know, a half dozen or so issues of The Dreamery in order to get it. It should be where some new reader can find it.
Yeah.
So that's just something I'm glad to do.
Although back issues of The Dreamery are worth getting, in bargain bins and wonderful reads, even the stuff that's not by Diane.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I've reprinted some of the stuff that's not by Diane.
Uh-huh.
Leela Dowling illustrated a great adaptation of Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, she did.
And I'm sitting there going, here's a great adaptation of Alice in Wonderland. That's a very mainstreamy book. There's no reason that it's not between two covers. So I also issued that.
Yeah, and her version was just wonderful.
Oh, yeah. Well, Leela's just a very playful,
yes,
playful artist. And The Dreamery had a sister magazine called Fusion. It was more of a science fiction series that Leela did a lot of the art for. And the first storyline was written by Stephen Barnes, who's a very respected science fiction author. And that was material that, again, had never been collected into a book. And, you know, Phil Foglio did some. There's a lot of good people on it. And so I collected that into a series of books. And so the Complete Fusion is also available from About Comics.
Good for you. How do you keep this stuff in print for such a long time?
Well, at this point, most of what I do is print on demand.
Mm-hmm.
So it stays in print forever because I'm not sitting on a warehouse full of them anymore. When I started out, I was a straight common comics publisher, doing comics and book materials and going through Diamond distribution to reach the comic shops and to reach bookstores through the Diamond's book distribution arm. And I did a lot of this stuff that way and I made some profit that way. But after a while, it became clear to me that I had to grow or shrink a bit,
mm-hmm,
in order to really keep going. And yeah, I'm a very risk-averse kind of guy. I mean, I looked at doing some big stuff. I looked at getting the comic book rights to adapt The Princess Bride, which would have been a great comic, and I had a great artist lined up. But I eventually said, that's a big financial risk. I'm going to go the other way. And so I switched to print-on-demand, and I can be free to put out something without worrying whether it's going to make a lot of money because it's not going to lose me a lot of money. And that really freed me up to put out a lot of other things. So because of that, I can put out something like the Fusion Collections and I can put them out even if there's no immediate demand for them. I'm not stuck with a warehouse full of them. And the moment I can find a way to point people to it and say, hey, Fusion's out there, you should go buy that.
Right.
I can. So the traditional comic book distribution market is really weird, and it's true of actually a lot of the book market, but it's especially true for comic books, that you have to go and get people interested in demanding the book before it exists, before they can see it. You have to have them going to comic book shops and telling them, in 3 months I want this book, because that's the only way the retailers will order it. And then you have to re-energize your entire potential readership 3 months later to go pick it up when it comes out,
right,
so that the retailer will reorder it. And if you're not constantly doing that, then it just disappears entirely. But I can do a book now, come up with a book, get it ready, make it available, and then at any given opportunity, I can start promoting it. And when I promote it, I can send people directly to buy it. You know, it's available for immediate sale. I don't need to turn them into my sales force convincing retailers to carry it. It's available.
And it's, I really want to emphasize what you said about worrying about losing money on publishing, because for independent publishers, that's a real consideration. I've been one myself, so it's out there.
Oh, yeah. And, you sit there and you have to print up all the books you think you're going to sell over the next few years all up front, and if you guess too many, you're left with a pile of books that you're actually paying for warehouse space to hold. And I went through the painful thing of actually having to pay somebody to destroy piles of books after my warehouse, the warehouse I was using was closing. And it was, I either pay for them there or pay for them to be destroyed or pay for them to be shipped somewhere else where they would just take up warehouse space for years.